If you've recovered from COVID-19 or unknowingly been exposed to it, you may have antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients. Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies. Visit Vitalant.org today.
It's the Innovation Podcast with Mark Reed Edwards and Garnett Harriman. Let's start the show.
Hey, Garnett, how's it going?
Going great. Got sports on my mind these days, sports, tech, and innovation. What are you thinking about?
Well, we are going to talk about opportunity zones soon. So I thought in this one-on-one, we could maybe tackle that. And then just a couple of minutes ago, as we were preparing for this, we talked for quite a while about esports and kind of the dynamics of what's going on that's causing esports to grow. That is a really interesting line of thinking. So I thought maybe we could end with that. But opportunity zones is a concept that we're hearing a lot about. And there was legislation, I think, last summer that kind of pushed it into reality. What's up with that?
Well, opportunity zones are brand new. They were formed as a result of an act passed by Congress, and some point during this, I'll give you the name of the name of the actual litigation legislation rather. But the long and the short of it is this, and there's a little some backstory. There's some provenance on it. It was started under Obama, but shockingly enough, approved under Trump. It has a lot of sort of social venture, social entrepreneurship energy behind it.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's a great investment vehicle. The basic concept is pretty simple. You take the sale of an asset, and the asset doesn't have to be something like real estate, although that is one of the use cases that fits well. It could also be the sale of stock or it could just be cash that you have to invest.
Mm-hmm.
And put it into a vehicle that is self-reporting as an opportunity zone fund. And, you know, the opportunity zone fund, in addition to the self-reporting, it has to basically be, you know, has to have an investment strategy focused on, you know, very specific things. Affordable housing is the big thing in the real estate class. But then it's also able to invest in enterprises, local enterprises, startups, tech-focused enterprises. And the whole concept is basically to create affordable housing as well as overall economic development in places like the inner city in particular, and also rural areas. You know, the inner city and rural areas being places that aren't typically the focus of a lot of venture and private equity investing. So if the fund checks all the boxes according to the requirements, the capital gains that come out of the fund are completely sheltered. So you go from whatever the capital gains rate is to zero.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, the longer you hold it, the longer the investor leaves his or her money in the fund, the basis can be reduced. So you have to sort of look at the accounting arcana, but the basic concept is if I put in, you know, $1 million, I can get as much as a 15% reduction, so that not only am I not paying capital gains, but any sort of taxes associated with that investment would be reduced by 15% if I let it stay long enough.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. So the uninitiated, you know, folks who aren't used to looking at the way investment vehicles create, you know, ROI and ROE, that kind of head start has a very simple upshot that I think everyone can appreciate. It lowers the bar for the performance on the investments that come out of that fund significantly, because it's so tax advantaged. So netting out all the arcana and the bullshit, you can get venture capital like returns, 20 and 25 and 30% returns on your money for investments that are far less risky than typical venture type investments.
Right.
That's like having your cake and eating it too. That's, you know, forgive my French, that's fucking amazing.
Yeah, so what kinds of things are you looking at or colleagues looking at? What kinds of things are happening in these opportunity zones? I've got a website up that shows where opportunity zones are throughout the country, and there is a large swath
I know
of opportunity zones right in the middle of the country and in, you know, on either coast, there's places, you know, that look ripe for opportunity zones as well. So what's happening? What kinds of investments are these industrial things? You know, what kinds of things are happening?
You know, I don't know how it's going to shake out in the middle of the country, to be perfectly honest. If you dig deep enough, you start to see that some of the stuff in the middle of the country is in those rural areas or in secondary, that's being generous, probably more like tertiary type city markets. You know, the overwhelming conclusion for most coastal money, you know, East Coast or West Coast, is who gives a shit?
Right.
There's not a lot of potential upside necessarily in some of those areas that you described in the middle of the country. That's, you know, I'm sure we're going to get hate mail from St. Louis and Chicago and Minnesota, but those aren't necessarily the area. I don't know what there is to invest in Wyoming per se. I don't know what there is to invest in North Dakota, South Dakota. So that's a tricky thing to comment on. Even on the East Coast and the West Coast and some of the bigger actual secondary markets, actual primary city markets around the country, there's plenty to bite into. There's plenty to sort of look at there. And I should preface any sort of commentary with this. This is literally the dawn. This is like the 6 a.m. Of a very long week ahead of us.
Yeah.
It's a 6 a.m. on Monday, and honestly, the jury is going to be out until Sunday at midnight or something, right? We got a long, we have a good stretch ahead of us till we are at the stage right now where I would say there's been fewer than a dozen funds actually raised that are specifically, you know, meaning all finished with the fundraising. I mean, there's probably scores of funds that are in progress, but there's probably a dozen or less funds that are completed that are focused on being and acting and, you know, conducting themselves as an opportunity zone fund that were marketed as an opportunity zone fund and will conduct themselves that way. So it's kind of a wild west at the moment. And part of the really interesting thing that you see, even in these developed cities, right, primary and secondary city markets, the opportunity zones that are designated include some very counterintuitive regions. Mm. So the opportunity zone in Los Angeles is something I've been studying. There's a big piece of the opportunity zone in Los Angeles that goes right through Hollywood. There's a big piece that goes through basically South LA, which is, you know, not the nicest of neighborhoods necessarily, but certainly, you know, lower middle class type neighborhoods, which counterintuitive. There's a piece of that literally adjacent to, it's across the street from the LA Lakers stadium. Like I I've studied the Chicago opportunity zone a little bit. There's something very similar, like across the street from White Sox stadium, it's the opportunity zone.
Yeah. And looking at the map right now in LA, I mean, there's a huge band that goes right through the center of LA.
Yep. It's south and central. Yep. Yep, that's exactly right.
What's interesting is I zoom out on this map, all of Puerto Rico is an opportunity zone.
I was going to mention that, actually. That's a very interesting thing. I mean, clearly it's to do with the need, right? Yeah. Post-natural disaster, there's an unusual level of need. Plus, it's, you know, in the U.S., plus it's essentially a resort island, right? I mean, so the combination of macro things going on there could be very exciting to watch, for sure.
Right.
I don't have any firsthand contact with it, but it's one of the things that I'm definitely watching. I think that there's something else happening. There's another theme that's emerging in this emerging investment segment or investment market of the opportunity zones. So in the last couple of months, there have been a couple of significant nonprofits. There's a nonprofit called Smart Growth America that's very well respected and very well partnered and, you know, has a pretty long reach as far as its research and policy initiatives. And they came out with a study that basically says that they focused a lot on the West Coast cities like Seattle and Portland and San Francisco. And they were saying that basically the opportunity zone, despite its provenances as being, you know, set up for community development and affordable housing development, is going to fail miserably in certain cities like those three I mentioned, because investors are coming in and essentially acting like carpetbaggers. They're going to put their money into investments. It's going to gentrify the neighborhoods because there's such a strong need for it with all these young people coming into the tech market in those cities. And the real estate prices are going to go up, and all of the locals will be left, you know, holding the bag and left out of the wealth creation, not only around real estate asset appreciation, but also around jobs creation. Even though it's 6 a.m. on Monday morning, right, according to my metaphor, there's a backlash already against investors using this as a vehicle. And so I'm going to make a prediction. There are going to be some major, for instance, there's a group called CIM that just raised, I think, $100 million fund. And that's based around LA and Hollywood. I will make you a prediction. There will be some of these larger funds, you know, let's say 50 million and up, that come out. And they will, in major cities, primary and secondary type, you know, markets, and they will have trouble putting the money to work.
Right.
Yeah, because of the backlash. You know, I just think the climate in this country is so focused on identifying these drivers of divisiveness, these drivers of like wealth gaps, among other things, that no one's going to sit still and watch that sort of stuff happen. Conversely, I think there's room for much smaller investment pools, 15 million, 12 million, 20 million, whatever, that have much more of a community-centric, inclusive type strategy, you know, that take the time to do the legwork and the groundwork for coalition building and ecosystem building and, you know, who have their mission statements in the right place. And I think some of those funds will do very well for themselves. It's going to be interesting to watch, actually. You know,
it's kind of like impact investing in a way, right? So it may be a category of that.
It's very much related. That would be, I would say this would be a segment of that. And it definitely matches that macro economic trend and that macro social zeitgeist. It is definitely a part of that.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Speaking of making the world a better place, impact investing, how about esports? You know, making the world safe for kids so that they don't get hurt playing football, you know,
that's a good one. That's a good segue. It's like the first ever concussion free pro sports.
Yeah. Well, unless you jump up from your chair and hit your head on the ceiling or something, I guess that could happen. But it's interesting. Esports were kind of made fun of a few years ago. There was just, you know, snot-nosed kids in their basement playing sports. And then people started to be able to make money doing this.
Yep.
And now you can make a lot of money doing this. And that, you know, pricks up the ears of anybody, you know, in business. And so I think there are esports you can see on regular TV, not just Twitch. I think ESPN or one of those networks runs esports on occasion. But you and I have kind of a shared belief that within 10, 20 years, some period of time, that in America, the bulk of sports that we tune into on the weekends or weeknights won't exist, certainly not in their current form, because of a lot of different things, but specifically football because of injuries and CTE and you know, all the things surrounding that. And that esports will kind of fill that void. Did I characterize that right? I spoke for you. I know that. So I'll let you speak now.
I think you're more than capable of speaking for me. You and I spent a lot of time brainstorming over these things. So I think we know each other's positions pretty well. That was an absolutely accurate characterization. And I think it takes a little bit of, energy to sort of project yourself 20 years into the future and sort of think big trends, macro developments, you know, big social changes. But I think when you start being comfortable looking at that type of, you know, meta calculus, right? I think some of the conclusions that come out of that macro analysis are not good for pro sports leagues as we know them today.
Yeah.
The big three, right? The big three, NFL, NBA, MLB, can, you know, just have a quick scan. It's beyond me to think that basically the NFL can survive, you know, in its current form in a post shareholder class action concussion lawsuit. world. Right. that when the you know, I know they're getting hit with a steady stream of them, but I think there is going to be one or more massive MDL, multi-district litigation class action lawsuits that end up costing them billions.
Yeah.
And I think when that happens, the biggest blow to them is not going to be the economic part. The biggest blow is going to be that every mother and father in the country that hadn't already changed their mind about letting their, 8-year-old or 12-year-old play contact football will change their mind.
Mm.
And the negative exposure and the negative PR that'll come out of that will have intergenerational consequences. You and I have talked about the feeder system already breaking down for NFL, right? So, lots of moms and dads are not letting their kids play contact football at age 8 or 9 or 10. So that's already changing. The sad truth of it is that the NFL is like the poster child for what's wrong with U.S.-based pro sports. My humble opinion is that the unifying element is that all of these pro sports are built for excess. And I'm pretty sure a lot of people would grok that intuitively, but, I'll give you some of my take on excess. Excess, meaning, body type getting bigger and stronger and more freakishly, developed as far as musculature. Excess as far as violence. Excess as far as, the type of hitting and tackling that's typically condoned on the field. Rule changes, the recent spate of rule changes aside, it's a fairly bloodthirsty sport. It's fairly excessive. People celebrate, knocking the other guy out in ways that are only really present in martial arts or boxing or MMA. It's just, strange to think of in a team sport. NBA built for people of a certain stature, right? Certain height, certain strength and musculature. And then the MLB is excessive in its romance of boredom, basically.
Yeah, it's a great game, but it's too slow.
It's a great game to play.
Yeah.
It's a great game to play. It's not a great game to watch. That's not good.
Yeah, I think that fortunately, for the most part, they've figured out the safety issues, like getting hit in the face with a baseball, things like that. But it really is a kind of lifestyle issue for MLB, figuring out how to engage younger people in watching that pastime.
Yep. I think you're absolutely right.
So where esports comes in.
Yeah, that's where esports comes in.
You can play these games. You can watch professionals play these games. And nobody gets hurt. And it doesn't have to take 4 hours to watch a 9-inning baseball game, right?
Yep. That's exactly right. Esports has more at my working, trying to make sense of the world around me all the time, and especially as an investor. My investment thesis about esports is that it has way more in common with soccer, or what the rest of the world calls football outside of the U.S. in that you've made the observation yourself to me in our conversations that soccer really requires, some flat ground and not even necessarily marked as a soccer field and a ball.
Right.
Not even regulation size ball. I've seen kids all over the world play soccer with things that look like Nerf balls to me, but whatever.
Yeah.
So all that's good. Esports, obviously, it requires, more technology and an internet connection, for the most part. But by and large, it requires far less equipment, human and technology infrastructure, media infrastructure. It requires a lot less than the big three U.S.-based pro sports leagues. Esports have been busily stealing from the playbook, no pun intended, of the media coverage of how people watch the other, pro sports leagues, in that you have these high production values, you have these, you have these broadcasts, you have these live streams, all that stuff. And there's a lot of blitzy production value around that stuff. And there's organized teams and there's owners of teams. And so that's, all of that's familiar. But fundamentally, the people up on the stage playing sports competitively against players in other teams are not freakishly big, strong, fast, muscled. They're kind of like geeky everyman,
right?
Every person. So
Oh, that's another thing, dude. Think about that. It's inherently co-ed. I mean, there's literally nothing that stops a woman from playing at the same level of a man in any of these games. Nothing.
Yeah, it's more egalitarian.
It's inherently gender equal or gender neutral, right?
So some people may say, well, but it's contrived. And my response to that will be, like, the NFL isn't contrived.
Exactly. Exactly. You could look back at the history of the game and then correlate that with rules changes by year, by decade, and you'll see how contrived it is.
And I enjoy football, so I enjoy...
So do I. I grew up watching.
What's kind of funny about football, I also watched a lot of F1. I'm a big F1 fan. And in F1, there has been such amazing development in protecting the driver that deaths, which used to be commonplace in F1, are now rare. They've figured out how to protect the driver. In football, they put helmets on and things like that, but they haven't really figured out how to protect the quarterback from heinous injury to their knee or to their head, and they haven't figured out how to protect other players. There's been a kind of show of making changes to the helmets, but they really haven't done anything substantive to prevent these really horrible injuries, whereas some other sports have addressed it.
And it's limited in what they can do.
What can you do? Yeah.
If you think through the opposing forces here, right? So the narrative value, right? The dramatic or theatrical value of pro football in particular has to do with this heroic male versus male struggle. It taps into something absolutely iconic and primeval, literally like Spartans versus Athenians.
Yeah.
And maybe not so ironically, there are plenty of teams around the country that are called Spartans. But you know, it has this militaristic do or die battle cry type ethos around the narrative. And so if you worked, even if pro football were to succeed at technologizing the hell out of the danger and regulating the danger via a spate of new rules and stiff penalties for enforcement and all this kind of stuff, even if that were to happen, the outcome would still be as dire as I'm forecasting and you're forecasting. Yeah. The game would change so much, it would basically dilute itself out of existence.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, it'd be flag football or something.
Which
right?
is totally fine. But, you know, no one, you know. Yeah. And last time I checked, NBC and CBS and ABC and ESPN really don't give a shit about paying millions of dollars for the broadcast rights for the World Flag Football League. You know, they really don't care. And there's a reason for that.
What's interesting is, you know, we're talking esports here. We're talking, you know, big rights packages that these networks are willing to pay for. But it's that whole business is being turned on its head with services like Netflix and Amazon Prime, where people's viewing habits are changing. And there's so much else that you can watch, esports being one of those things. So the base of viewers available to watch the Super Bowl or the World Series or just a regular game on a Sunday afternoon is getting smaller because people do other things. And that's what funds the advertising for the networks to pay these billions of dollars. And so that's just fundamentally changing. So these huge rights packages, there'd probably be a few more of these to happen in the next 5-10 years. But eventually that money just isn't going to be there.
Yep. Yep. And, you know, some of them were far-sighted broadcast conglomerates, right? So are starting to try to pivot and figure out how to apply some of the old broadcast licensing models to what's happening. In 2018, this is not long ago, there were two milestones, both of them by Disney. In July, made a deal with video game publisher Activision Blizzard to broadcast Overwatch League. That's their marquee
gaming property.
Yeah.
You know, on multiple Disney channels. Then they followed that up in November 2018, and they made another deal with a video game publisher, Jam City. So think about how the world is changing, right? If you weren't watching these two milestones and the deal rags, like I read a lot of deal rags about investment deals and licensing deals. And if you were not watching this, you wouldn't know that the same company associated with an entertainment property that goes back to the 1920s, 1930s, whenever Mickey Mouse first came out, is trying to get its foot, you know, one foot squarely planted into the future of esports. That's a big data point for directional data point for where the market is headed.
So the NFL and MLB will be around in some form for a while, but esports will go really mainstream before those two sports that I just mentioned start to fade away. What do you think the timing is for that?
Okay, so it depends on what that means, right? So the mainstreaming of esports as far as like entertainment broadcasting, I think.
Yeah.
So I think the live, audience sort of viewing of these spectacles, esports spectacles, is going to be analogous to what we saw in the past with pro sports.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the people at home actually want to watch it the same way that the people at home would have been watching pro sports.
Sure.
And I think that's part of the appeal. And that's a generational difference, in my opinion. You know, the fact that I can, watch my favorite Fortnite player on Twitch at all hours of the day and night, it just has to be a time when he decides he's playing.
Yeah.
Versus, Sunday afternoon at 6 p.m. or 4 p.m. or whatever, right? That whole notion of appointment viewing, I think is going to go out the window with esports, and already has with the rise of Twitch. The Twitch network has as many views of its live stream, collective live stream broadcast, as YouTube does. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, YouTube is a juggernaut unto itself, but also it's a decade old, or more. Twitch is a couple of years old, 3 years old.
Yeah.
That's astonishing. I'm pretty sure in the next year or so, they're going to just surpass YouTube. So the future is around, gaming live streamers like Twitch, not around YouTube. YouTube's going to be pretty profitable for lots of other reasons. But what's really exciting about esports, in my opinion, and not surprisingly, these are some of the investments that I'm looking at personally and in some of the investment groups that I belong. I'm really excited about where the mainstream broadcasting concept, even though that's going to be different than previous mainstream broadcast, where that starts to connect up to major brands, especially consumer product goods.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so right now, if you think about it, there really isn't a platform for connecting brands to either the live streamers themselves, the game players, or the fan base, the viewers of the live streamers. There's no real way to connect brands to them. So obviously, that has to be solved.
Right.
And that has to be, and there's probably plenty of room for multiple solutions to that. But, there's nothing out there. If I wanted to sell Kraft American cheese slices to, kids sitting on the couch, which not necessarily a bad product market fit, pretty good fit actually. There's currently no way to do that, and that has to change.
Well, it'll be interesting to watch, won't it?
Yeah, it's an exciting little sort of sweet spot in the Venn diagram of some of these bigger trends to keep an eye out for.
Yeah, I wonder whether there will be any esports related to opportunity zones, what we discussed earlier. It'd be interesting to see if that'll happen.
It's stranger things have happened, and it makes a lot of sense, right? Because at least in the cities, the opportunity zones are in places like the inner cities, and God knows there are plenty of kids in the inner cities that play games and play esports. There's a long tradition of putting stadia in the inner cities, because it's central and people, it's easy to get to, and there's typically tax breaks that go with it. So, a lot of the elements that would have had pro sports being situated in and around inner cities actually make sense for esports as well.
And I think one of the enablers here will be ubiquitous 5G, something that then is available to people everywhere, and the technology is portable. They can take their devices with them and play these games or watch these games no matter where they are.
Yeah. And you can, you know, some of that already exists just with, you know, standard mobility stuff, but it's hard to be away from your console, right, when you're playing a game and live streaming it. So, yeah, maybe there'll be virtual, you know, or AR, augmented reality type consoles that allow you to play wherever you are in the world, headsets. So there's already a technology that utilizes empty glass storefronts to create digital billboards. Maybe people are going to play in the inner city on empty glass storefronts, you know, when you can when you can project the console and the game on any glass storefront that is in an urban area. I don't know. Stranger things have happened.
I get the sense that we will probably talk about this quite a lot in our series of programs.
And hear from experts and, you know, inventors and entrepreneurs who are on the front lines of making some of these trends come together.
All right, next time, Garnett and I are talking with Panos Mutafis, co-founder of Zenus, a Houston-based company that is at the cutting edge of facial recognition. We also have Peter Stewart of Outlier Capital lined up for a chat that continues our discussion of opportunity zones. Plus, we have Mark Gallagher, a world-renowned expert on Formula One, scheduled. He'll chat about the safety innovations in F1 as well as the esports angle. See, it all makes sense. Lots more to come here on the iPod.
Thanks for joining Garnett and Mark on the Innovation Podcast. Visit innovationpodcast.co to subscribe and listen to other episodes.